Turn to Exodus chapter 33. Yes, that is correct. Exodus 33. We are on the way to the Gospel of Mark chapter 6. But first, two pieces of background in order to make sense of Mark's writing. Are you ready to get to work? The eight was sleepy. No offense to the eight, but you're not here, so I can slam you. I need a little bit of love from the ten, okay? Exodus, yeah, that's okay. Exodus 33, skip down to 18. Moses is out in the desert with God, and he said, "Now show me your glory, God." Put another way, show me what you are like. And Yahweh, or in English, the Lord, all caps, said, "I will cause all my goodness to," and then listen, "pass in front of you." Notice the language, pass in front of you. Remember that. And I will proclaim my name, Yahweh, in your presence. Now, if you remember the God Has a Name series from earlier this year, a name in the ancient Near East was way more than a label like George or Robert or Sarah. A name was your core identity. It's what made you, you. And God says, "I will proclaim my name." Then 21, Yahweh said, "This is the place near me where you may stand on a rock, and when my glory," what? "Passes by," there it is again, "passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed." Now, God does not have a hand, per se, but this passage is filled with anthropomorphic language about God. For example, 23, "Then I will remove my hand, you will see my back, but my face must not be seen." Now, this word "back" right here is slippery to translate from Hebrew into English. It can be translated "the place where I just was," meaning the closest that you, Moses, can get to me is my back, is the place where I just was. And that's exactly what happens. Skip down to chapter 34, verse 5. "He passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, 'The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness.'" And the text goes on. Now you remember, you already know this text from earlier this year. This is the most quoted verse in all of the scriptures by the biblical authors. They circle back to this over and over again because this right here is ground zero for a theology of God. This is God's self-disclosure statement. It's God's self-revelation. It's God saying, "This is who I am. I'm compassionate, I'm gracious, I'm slow to anger," and the rest. Now, here's all you need to know for today. Notice how God revealed himself. He passed by. Not once, not twice, but three times we read the phrase, "He passed by," meaning he revealed himself to Moses. Does that make sense? You got that? Pretend, nod, smile. That's all I ask for. Not even that? Three? Okay. Whatever. That's piece one. Moving on. Secondly, turn over to Job to the right. Job, or if you're new to the Bible, Job. I mean, technically, it's the exact same word. Job 9, if you have never read Job before, basically, it's an ancient play. Think of it as Shakespeare 2 millennia before the time of Christ. Except it's a bit weirder, and there's a cameo or two from Satan, okay? Now, let's read one excerpt right out of Job chapter 9, verse 1. This is in the middle of a dialogue. "Then Job replied, 'Indeed, I know this is true. How can mere mortals prove their innocence before God? Though they wished to dispute with him, they could not answer him once in 1,000 times. His wisdom is profound. His power is vast. Who has resisted him and come out unscathed?'" Now, listen, this is Job talking about God. Listen, "He moves mountains without their knowing it. He overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth from its place. He makes its pillars tremble. He speaks to the sun, and it does not shine," which we know all too well. "He seals off the light of the stars. He alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea." Now that last phrase, "treads on the waves of the sea," can be translated, "walks on water." And this imagery of a God who walks on water is actually used not only here in Job, but all through what you and I call the Old Testament. For example, Psalm 77,
The waters saw you, God. The waters saw you and writhed. The very depths were convulsed. The clouds poured down water. The heavens resounded with thunder. Your arrows flashed back and forth. Your thunder was heard in the whirlwind. Your lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and quaked. Your path led through the sea, your way through the mighty waters, though your footprints were not seen. Over and over and over again in the scriptures, one of the ways that you know God is God is that he walks on water. Makes sense? There you are. With all of that in your mind, now you're ready. Turn over to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, to the right. It's in the New Testament. If you're new or visiting, we're in a series on Mark. And the plan is to work through line by line the next chunk of text, Mark 6, 45 down to 56. We left off last week with Jesus feeding 5,000 men right on the north edge of Galilee. There's a whole bunch in there. If you weren't here, listen to Ian's teaching. And then we pick up 45. Immediately, right after that, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat. Now, that word made can be translated forced, as in against his disciples' will. Peter, I don't care what you think. John, I don't care. Nope, right now he forced. Some of your Bibles say he constrained. He forced the disciples get into the boat and set out and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida, which was a fishing village on the northeast side of the lake, not far away at all, while he dismissed the crowd. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. So Jesus does not go with the disciples, all right? Jesus instead is up on top of a mountain, silent solitude to get alone with God, pray, think, wrestle, all of that. Now, 47, later that night, now this should have been a short trip, okay? But later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake, blown off course, and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. Now, that word straining is a graphic and violent word in Greek. It's bazaniso. Can you say that? Well done. And it can be translated and is torture. It's the exact same word used earlier in Mark when the demon says to Jesus, I adjure you, don't torture me. Don't bazaniso me. That's the idea. That this slow going, the disciples rowing, is brutal, hard, arduous. It's basically torture. And then, shortly before dawn, okay, now it's been all night. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them walking on the lake. And he was about to, what? Pass by them. Now, you should be thinking Job. You should be thinking Exodus. That phrase, pass by, is the exact same phrase that's used three times in Exodus 33, where God passed by Moses. Jesus was about to do that. But when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost, or in Greek, it's phantasm. They thought he was a ghost or a phantom or a spirit or worse. Remember that the sea in the ancient Near East was symbolic for evil and chaos and the demonic powers raging against God. The odds are they thought Jesus was a ghost or worse, a sea demon, which is why they cried out because they all saw him and were what? Terrified, scared to death, as you can imagine. But immediately he spoke to them. He said, whoa, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. Hey, it's me. Now that, by the way, it is I is a loaded phrase. More on that in a minute or two. But hey, take courage. It's okay. It's me, Jesus. Don't be afraid. Calm down. Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for, and this is interesting, they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. So the loaves was the afternoon before. Okay, this is Jesus with the 5,000 feeding 5,000 men, if not more, with women and children, with a boy's lunch, okay? But they didn't get it. They didn't learn what they were supposed to learn. They did not get it. But interesting, it's not in Mark's writing because they were stupid or dumb or uneducated or simple. It's because, quote, their hearts were hardened. Now, this is a phrase, well, in the Old Testament, this is used for Pharaoh.
And the one and only other time it's used in Mark is in chapter 2 when it's used of the Pharisees who see Jesus healing a man and get so mad that they, rather than follow Jesus, want to murder Jesus. And Mark writes, their hearts were hardened. And now it's Jesus' own disciples who are the Pharaoh, who are the Pharisees, whose hearts were hardened. This isn't because they were stupid. This is because they were stubborn and obstinate. They would not or could not trust and believe in Jesus. But in spite of all that, 53, when they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret and anchored there. Now, they were on the way where? Bethsaida, which is a fishing village on the northeast corner of the lake. Gennesaret is not a village at all. It's a region about 3 miles long, a mile deep, and it's on the southwest side of the lake. So the point here is they were blown way off course on the way to Bethsaida. Nope, not at all. Gennesaret. But then listen, 54, as soon as they got out of the boat, people recognized Jesus. They ran throughout that whole region, carried those who were ill on mats to wherever they heard he was, and wherever he went, into villages, towns, or countryside, they placed those who were ill in the marketplaces, and they begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak. That word edge is from the Hebrew word kanaf. Remember that from chapter 5? There was that prophecy in Malachi about how the coming Messiah, there would be healing in his healing powers in his kanaf, a Hebrew word for the edge of a Jewish man's prayer shawl, which is why that woman, she reached out and she touched the edge of Jesus' clothing. It was her way of saying, I believe, Jesus, that you are the Messiah. I believe that you are the one we have been waiting for hundreds of years. Well, that story, seems like, is out all over the place. And now there's not one woman. Now there are hundreds of men and women and children coming from all over to Jesus to reach out, to touch Jesus' kanaf. And in the exact same way, all who touched it were what? Healed. Now, that's the story. Listen, don't tune out right now. I know what you're thinking. In particular, if you have been around the church for any length of time, you're thinking, I know this story already. In fact, we already covered the storm story. This is the second one. Come on, it's like reruns of Mark, you know? We covered it like a month ago, and I know it like the back of my hand. If you're in a rough spot, Jesus is with you, blah, blah, blah. Great, okay, what's for lunch? Now, no, none of you are thinking that right now. None of you. Is that me? I get bored really easy, all right? So I don't ever buy a DVD. Why would you've already seen it. Why would you watch it again? How boring is that, you know, for $19.99? Give me a break. So if that's you right now, stay with me. This story is actually very different. The first one, the disciples' life is in danger, that's not going on here. The first one, Jesus is with the disciples, that's not going on here. He's up on a mountain. This one's actually very different. Stay with me. There's stuff under the surface for you and me. Now, first off, if you're taking notes, this is a story about God. Or to be more precise, about the godness of Jesus. Now, Mark is a writer, and he's not blunt, he's not uncouth, he's not simple. The way Mark writes, he never flat out says, Jesus is God, in the language of kind of the modern day church. Instead, Mark shows Jesus doing stuff that only God can do. For example, that's why chapter 2, the Pharisees' hearts were hardened, because Jesus said, I forgive your sins. Wait a minute, only God can do that. In chapter 4, Jesus said to the wind and the waves, quiet, be still. Whoosh, glass. Only God can do that. And then right here, Jesus is walking on what? Water. Now, wait a minute, only God can do that. And then on top of that, Mark writes that he was about to pass by them. Now, all of the red lights on your dashboard should be blinking right now. I used to read that for years, really until a few weeks ago, and think, what is that? Like Jesus, hey guys, on the way to get some falafel at Bethsaida. See you there. You know, like, what is that? About to pass by them? You know, and then he changed his mind or something? No, it's not what's going on at all. What's going on, this is Exodus language. This is Mark writing all of chapter 6 over against the backdrop of Exodus 33, God's self-disclosure, saving God's revelation on Mount Sinai, and saying that is what's going on right here in Jesus. Jesus is revealing God to the disciples. How? By revealing himself, because the two are fused together. Keep in mind that usually in Mark, and the same is true for Matthew and Luke and John, when Jesus does miracles, and we've talked about this before, it's by the Spirit's power. Now, the classic kind of Western post-Enlightenment explanation is, well, that proves that he was God. And while he is that, absolutely, he's the embodiment of that, that's not the right line of reasoning. Think that through. Elijah did miracles. In my opinion, more impressive miracles than healing the sick. Fire, anybody? Elisha did miracles. Peter did miracles. James, John, Paul later did miracles. We don't walk around and say, look, see, that's proof that Paul is God. No, we don't worship Paul as God. He was a rabbi. He was a man. But Jesus, we do. Why? Well, Jesus does miracles by the power of the Holy Spirit to show you and me what a real, true human being filled with the Spirit of God was supposed to look like all along. What Adam was supposed to look like, what you and I, how you and I were made to live. He does miracles by the power of the Spirit. But, caveat, nuance, every once in a while, and right here is a perfect example, you get Jesus flexing his God muscles, for lack of better language. It's not that he's here to show off, but this is more than a real true human being filled with the Spirit of God. He's walking on water, people. This is his way of saying, listen, I am that embodiment. That's what's going on. So you have Jesus walking on water. Then you have, in Mark's writing, about to pass by, self-revelation. And then on top of all that, Jesus says, take courage, it is I. Now, that is a loaded phrase. In Greek, it's the phrase ego eimi. And technically in Greek, it just means, hey, it's me. It is I. It is me. But it was the exact same phrase used in Exodus 33, at least in the Greek translation of it. And then all through the Old Testament, and then a ton of Jewish writings that are not in the Bible, but were written around the time of Jesus and then later Mark. That phrase was used for God. Remember what God said to Moses? Moses said, God, what is your name? And God said, I am that I am, or in the Greek translation, ego eimi. So this is Jesus. This is a blatant, overt way for Jesus to say that he is the embodiment of the Creator God. That's what's going on in this story. But the disciples, and here's what's crazy, don't get it. The disciples don't recognize Jesus, much less God in Jesus. In fact, they think that Jesus is a ghost. They just flat out don't recognize Jesus. Why? My guess is because Jesus was very different than the God they were expecting. And you know what? That happens all the time. I don't recognize God. My guess is you don't at times recognize God because he does not fit the stereotype. One of the mistakes that we make, in particular in the West, is that we start with the presupposition that we know what God is like. We know God is love, or God is this or that, the other. And then we believe or doubt in Jesus based on whether or not he fits into the box, into the stereotype, into what you think about God in your mind. But what's interesting to me is that the writers in the New Testament, Mark, for example, start with the exact opposite presupposition. You don't know what God is like. Yes, we get glimpses, for sure, in Israel's story. We get glimpses in the Torah. We get glimpses, Exodus 33. I mean, that is a revelation moment. God's compassionate, okay. God's gracious. God's slow to anger. God's abounding in love and faithfulness. We get glimpses, for sure, but it's God's back. It's the place where God just was. But in Jesus, we see God in a greater way than ever before. It's like God starts to come into focus. And now we see God's face. Now we see God as Jesus of Nazareth. We see what God is like. We hear his voice, his vocal inflection, his tone. Jesus is God speaking in a language that you and I understand. And that's one of my favorite things about Jesus. He's constantly challenging my assumptions about God. And I hope and pray he does the same for you. Because Jesus does not fit into the stereotype, and please listen to me, not of the right or of the left, not of the rich or of the poor, not of the American suburban Jesus or the Nigerian African Jesus. Jesus does not fit into the box that you and I create for him to call home. He's Jesus. And he's constantly challenging all of my assumptions about God. And what happens, and this happens more, I think, in America than anywhere else, is that we import into that English word God all sorts of stuff, all sorts of thinking about God, some of which is right, some of which is wrong. You all have a vision of God in your mind, all of you, myself included. We all have, this is who I think God is. Here's the problem. We are all wrong to some degree. Some of you are more wrong than me, but we are all we are all wrong to some degree. We all have stuff that we think about God that's right, hopefully. And the majority of us, not me, but you, have stuff that you, no, all of us, myself included, I have stuff that I think about God that, frankly, is not right. It's not in line with Jesus. It's not in line with the scriptures. I'm off. I have imported in my bias, my culture, my upbringing, my political leaning, how I view this, what I love, what I hate. And here's how you know God starts to look like, Jesus starts to look like you. When the Jesus that you follow agrees with you on everything, you're not following Jesus. Okay? When he votes how you vote, and he spends money how you spend money, and he hates who you hate, and he loves who you love, and like that's how you know. You're probably not following Jesus. You're following a figment of your imagination that you call Jesus to make yourself feel better. That's what I love about Jesus. He is the real true one, not the one I make up in my head. He is constantly challenging my assumptions about God. And this, my friends, is why you, and please listen to me on my soapbox here, this is why you and I have to read the Gospels 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Even if it's half a chapter, even if it's a paragraph, you have to read Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John and read about Jesus every single day. Jesus is not a warm, fuzzy feeling that you get when you go to church. Jesus is not the aura that hooked you up with a great date. Jesus was a, I mean, maybe he was in that, I don't know, but Jesus was a real flesh and blood person in history in the north part of Israel early in the first century, who was crucified for the Roman Empire, who was raised from the dead by the creator of the universe, and who is now Lord over all creation. He's not a religious myth. He's not a fairy tale. He's not a religious system. He's not a theology. He's a person. He's real. He was on the earth. And we need to know what he was like. It's why we're in the scriptures week after week. It's why we're in Mark for the next 5 years. It's why we do history. One of the reasons I do history is for you to know that Jesus was a real person. As dumb as that sounds, you need to get that. I need to get that. Otherwise, he starts to become this junk drawer of spirituality that basically means nothing. We have to be in the Gospels every single day praying. You remember the story, two things. Jesus, show me who you are, and Jesus, show me how to follow you. Are you in the Gospels day in? If not, wake up tomorrow morning. Go home this afternoon. It's raining outside anyway. Go home. Wake up tomorrow morning. Before you go to bed tonight, crack open Mark. I'm reading Luke right now. It's blowing my mind. Crack it open. Read a story. Jesus, show me who you are. Jesus, show me how to follow you. Are you letting Jesus challenge your assumptions about God? Are you letting Jesus build out your theology of God? You letting Jesus frame and paint and sculpt and shape what you think about when you think about God? Is it Jesus that is that one for you? This is a story about God. But then secondly, moving on, this is a story about us, right? I am the disciples, and so are you. Have you ever felt like the disciples in the storm, in the middle of the night, rowing against the wind and getting nowhere? You ever felt like that? Have you ever felt like you were made, like you were forced to do something against your will? Maybe by God, maybe by the Spirit, maybe just by your boss, maybe by your wife, that's a whole other sermon. Maybe you're like, I'm here, I was forced to come here, I'm sorry. By life circumstances, have you ever felt forced into something against your will? Have you ever felt like the wind was against you? Like every stroke is exhausting. Like it's been all night. It's been all year. It's been all decade. And I feel like I'm getting nowhere. Have you ever felt like you're alone? You're alone on the sea and Jesus is up on a mountain. You ever feel like that? Like God is distant from you, cold. Like God, you don't feel like God's with you in the boat. You don't feel like God's with you in your marriage and your suffering and your job that you hate, whatever. You feel like God is up on a mountain. He's cold. He's distant. He's far away. You ever feel like that? Have you ever felt discouraged? Like God is calling you to do, like God called you to do something, or at least you thought God called you to do something, and you set off in faith, but it's not going well. It's like the wind is against you. You're getting nowhere. Have you ever felt scared? Terrified is the word used in the text. Have you ever seen stuff on the horizon in the fog that is your future and you think it's a ghost? You think, what in the world is that? That's scary, and you worry and you stress, and you fear. Have you ever felt blown off course? Like you were on the way to Bethsaida and then here you are in Gennesaret. What the heck? Here was your 5-year plan. You thought it was from God. You thought it was a wise decision. But you're blown off course. If the answer to any of that is yes, and I'm guessing if you're human, at least one or two of them, then I wonder if Jesus would say to you and me today, keep rowing. I love that this story happens right before dawn. That time that I was up early this morning, which is rare for me, and it was pitch black outside, and I love that feeling right before dawn when it's still dark, but it's like darkness is losing its grip on the earth. And slowly but surely, darkness is giving way to light. I wonder if that's the spot that you're at right now. And I wonder if God would say to you, no matter how discouraged you are, keep rowing. Now, if you're anything like me, when you are in a storm, and once again, obviously, down through history, all over the world, a storm has been symbolic for just rough, hard, brutal stuff in life. If you're in a season like that or have been in the past, trust me, you will be again in the future. If you're anything like me, I want a ticket out. I just want out, right? Jesus, come down off the mountain. You walk on water, great. Give me a lift, piggyback ride. I want out. Take me out right now. But instead, Jesus does two things. One, he reveals God in the storm. The disciples saw a revelation of God, but here's what's striking to me, right in the middle of the sea. Now, Jesus could have walked the disciples up the mountain. Right? After all, this is the ancient Near East. They actually thought of heaven as up. That's why they would go up a mountain to pray. They thought they were closer to God. Jesus could have walked the disciples up a mountain to a retreat center. Here's a cup of tea and a French press and a moleskin and a candle. Go be alone for a day. And that's where the revelation could have happened, right? But instead, Jesus forced the disciples right into the middle of a storm, into the sea, symbolic for evil and chaos. But so often, that is where we see God. It's on the mountain, sure, that happens later in chapter 9. But so often, we don't see God on the mountain. We see God in the middle of the sea. We see God in the crisis. We see God in the diagnosis. We see God in the operating room. We see God in the divorce. We see God in stuff that is brutal and painful and hard. That is where we experience God. That's where we know God. That's where we learn more and more of what God is like. I mean, the adoption process, which is going fantastic now, but early on was really hard for my wife and I, and waiting, you know, it's a long process, long, hard process, and waiting, and we were over in Uganda, and it was scary, and we thought we were going to lose our daughter, and you're dealing with the pain of her story, and you're absorbing all of that pain into your life. It was brutal, but I learned more about God through that experience than any class in seminary I have ever had, ever. Before that, I knew on paper that God was for the fatherless. Now I actually understand what it means that God's heart is for the fatherless, that God is on the side of the fatherless. I get that now. I did not before. Something happens in those moments, right? You see God. There's a revelation. There's an encounter. You learn what God is like. Are you in turbulent waters right now? If so, keep your eyes open. Who knows what is right off the bow in the fog? Who knows what there is that you can learn through this experience? Who knows what there is that you can know about God? So Jesus reveals God in the storm, and then secondly, he brings good stuff out of the storm. That's what he does. Right? The plan was to go to Bethsaida. They ended up instead in Gennesaret, but God used it. Who knows how many people, hundreds it sounds like, if not thousands, were healed. And life is like that. How many times has your plan, what was supposed to happen, what you thought God said, you thought this is what was supposed to happen, but you were blown off course. You thought you were called to Bethsaida, you ended up in Gennesaret. You thought you were called here, you ended up there. You thought it was going to be fantastic, it was not. But how often has it worked out in the end for good? To the point where you say, you know what, if that lousy thing had never happened, then this good thing would have never happened. Am I alone in that? My guess is not at all. Now, to clarify, that does not mean that the storm or the hardship or the divorce or the pain or the cancer or whatever was God's plan or God's will or that he made the wind do its thing in the story at all. It just means that no matter what happens, God can bring good out of it. Our comfort is not that everything that happens is God's will, that there's some divine blueprint for every lousy thing that happens to you in life. I think a ton of stuff, in my opinion, and lots of smart people disagree with me, but they're wrong. But no, in my opinion, lots of stuff happens that isn't God's will at all. Stuff that is flat out wrong, evil, injustice, pain, that's just nasty. But our hope is not that everything that happens is God's will. Our hope is that no matter what happens, Jesus can walk on water. No matter what happens to you, whether it's God's plan for your life or the antithesis of God's heart and will and soul for your life, no matter what happens to you, no matter how broken or painful or abusive or evil or rotten it is or disappointing it is, you follow a Jesus who can walk on water. That means he can bring good out of anything. He can bring good out of divorce, which is something he says he hates. He can bring good out of abuse. He can bring good out of unemployment. He can bring good out of failure. He can bring good out of disappointment. He can bring good out of anxiety and depression. He can bring good out of addiction. He can bring good out of anything. All you have to do is let him into your boat. As captain, obviously, duh, to borrow from the 80s. But all you have to do is let him into your boat. Now, if you let him pass by, you're on your own. Have at it. But if you let him into your boat, immediately the wind died down, end quote. But the disciples' hearts were hardened, end quote. Meaning, as I said, they were stubborn, obstinate. They could not, or worse, would not trust and believe after all they had been through. And that's the crazy thing. They had just seen Jesus feed 5,000 men, if not more, with a brown paper bag. They had just seen that. But somehow, they were scared to death. They could not, they would not trust and believe. Now, it's easy to mock the 12. Oh, how stupid. Oh, how dumb. Ha, ha, ha. But we are Peter, James, and John, right? It's the whole point of the story. I read this and I think, dang it, that's me. How often has God been faithful to me, faithful to you, through this experience, through that, through the other, year after year, decade after decade, God has been faithful to you. But how often do we still freak out and get terrified, get scared, get frustrated, get mad, get bitter at God, question God, doubt God, wonder where he is when he was just there the afternoon before? But we don't believe. And the invitation here, what I love about Jesus is he doesn't get mad at the disciples. I would. Freaking, I just fed 5,000 men. What the heck? You know? It's a good thing I'm not Jesus. You're all thinking, for once, we all agree with you. Right? He doesn't get mad. Instead, all he says, the 12 men who are scared, doubting, questioning, who would not or could not trust and believe, instead, he just says, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. And that, my friends, is the invitation to all of you who follow Jesus. And if you're not a follower of Jesus, There's a first invitation. Follow Jesus. And then take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. And I love that. I love that frame of reference. First off, take courage. Don't get scared. Lean into the wind. Dive in head first. Courage is a lost art. It's a virtue that I think is slipping through the cracks right now in the West. Of course, on TV, we still have heroes and Superman and Tony Stark and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we have soldiers. But for the most part, for the average Joe, for you and for me, courage is slipping through the cracks. I mean, you see this all the time in parenting. Oh, my gosh. In my opinion, modern-day parenting can be summed up in two words. Be careful. Right? Go to Babies R Us. Don't. It's horrible. But half of the place is safety equipment. Like, you're already in an SUV that's 8 feet wide. You don't need four more. Go to the park. Listen to the chatter of moms and dads for 5 minutes. Count up how many times you hear people say, be careful. It's a park. It's a swing. Be careful, be careful. Johnny, be careful. You're the next American Idol. Be careful. You know? So I make it a point as a dad, and this is probably immaturity, not wisdom, so you filter it for yourself. But I make it a point to basically never let those two words out of my mouth, particular at a playground. I prefer language like, go for it. You got it, Jude. Oh, it's not that high. Jump, go for it. That's bark dust at the bottom, you know? Now, you're thinking, if you work for DHS, you're thinking, I think I need to call the cops. But you know why? And this is going to sound brutal, but I am not scared of Jude breaking his leg. But I'm terrified of Jude growing up to be the kind of man who's scared to climb a tree. Because one of the most disheartening traits in a man or in a woman is cowardice. I mean, read in the closing image of the Bible in Revelation, there's this crazy list of the people that are shut out from God's presence forever. And it's the usual suspects. It's, you know, the adulterers and the murderers. But you know what's on that list? The cowardly. Now, I don't usually put murder and adultery and sorcery in the exact same category as cowardice. But God does. Because to live in God's kingdom, to follow Jesus, is in itself an act of courage. When I was in Raleigh last weekend, about 150 people at the first weekly gathering of the church and that we planted. And about 50 of the 150 were from here. You could tell who was who. They were all wearing skinny jeans, even though it was 90 plus degrees and were dripping in humidity, right? Like, oh, you're from Portland, huh? Why are you wearing a scarf? Oh, seriously. But you look cool, all right, you know? But it was amazing talking with these men and women, a bunch of whom I actually had never met before, a bunch of whom were super involved here, who picked up everything and moved all the way to the East Coast, to the humidity, to help plant this church, to form the first few missional communities. There were six to start with on the first day from 50 people. Man, that is an act of courage. No family, no job, no place to live, no clue what's coming, just a heart to follow Jesus and be there from the ground up. What is that? That is courage. That's what Jesus is saying. That's how you and I are to live in the kingdom. That doesn't mean you're all called to move to Raleigh, although I'm sure Dom would welcome you. But you're all called to live with courage. Whatever's in front of you, whatever you're scared of, whatever's on the horizon, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, is it a ghost? Is it? Now take courage. And then Jesus says, it is I. I wonder if that, see God at work in your life. How often do you see something in your life, see something on the horizon, see something coming at you, and you think it's a ghost? Actually, it's Jesus. You think it's this, you think it's that, you think, oh no. Actually, it is me. It is I. God's at work. I wonder if the very thing that right now you're scared about, the very thing that you stay up at night and you worry and you toss and you turn, I wonder if Jesus would say, it is I. I'm in this. Keep your eyes open. I'm at work. Doesn't mean he's the cause. Doesn't mean he's, if it's evil, doesn't mean he's the, but I wonder if Jesus would say, I'm here. See God at work. And here's the key. See God at work in all of your life. in the good and the bad, in the easy and in the hard. And what you see is a blessing, and maybe what you see is a curse. See God at work in all of that. Keep your eyes open, because if you follow Jesus, if you let Jesus into your boat, so to speak, he's there, trust me, and he's at work. And then the last thing Jesus says is don't be afraid. And I love it. Don't be, that's a command. I think of fear as an emotion. And my role in fear is passive. Fear is that something that happens to me, right? And to an extent, that's true, right? I'm scared to death of snakes, okay? Don't tell anybody. So not long ago, Bucky Buckstabber, our children's pastor, this was a while ago, actually, I have this really nice, like, high-end, expensive Bible. It's amazing. I love it, and I love it. So I keep it in a box, okay? And everybody makes fun of me because I keep my Bible in a box. So I had it on my desk in my box. Well, it's like a $200 Bible. This is like, this is goat skin, and I'm a vegetarian. This is a big deal, right? Seriously, it's hand-bound. I mean, this is like, this is my baby, all right? It's just, the smell is just, oh, it's idolatry, but it's amazing. So I had it in a box on my desk, and I went in from a meeting, and I opened up, and he put a live snake in there, and the snake jumped out into my lap. I have one thing that I'm terrified of. It's snakes. One thing. Why did I just tell 1,000 people that? That was horrible. Right? So there's an extent to where, like, it's just fear. It just happens to you. All right? You just cry and wet your pants and run out, and the secretary is there. You're like, oh, hi. Oh, okay. Right? That happens once in a while. All right? I just played a curse on Bucky. So that happens. But there is also a time when fear is a choice. It's a conscious decision that you make to go the way of fear and anxiety and worry, and or to go the way of courage and trust. And that's the invitation of Jesus. Take courage. Whatever you're up against right now, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. And so maybe you're here, and that's the word. Just keep rowing. Lean into the wind, because we follow a God who walks on water. Let's pray.